This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. As a hockey player at UW-Madison, Blake Jeffrion seemed to be destined for big things at the highest levels of the game. He had played for Team USA at many levels of youth hockey. He was drafted by an NHL team partway through college, elected to finish 4 years. After his senior year, he won the Hobie Baker Award as the top college hockey player in the country. Hockey was even in his blood. Pro hockey went back 4 generations, including the legendary Bernie Boom Boom Jeffrion, his grandfather. But just a couple years into his pro career, a horrific on-ice injury ultimately put an end to his playing days. A new book shares Blake's story. The author joins us now along with Blake Jeffrion himself. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Have you played competitive hockey yourself? What was your experience like in the sport? If you gave a big part of your life to any sport and your playing days ended, what was it like? How did you handle that transition? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or email ideas@WPR.org. Sam Jeffries is a freelance writer and communications professional and a UW-Madison graduate. He's author of the book Legacy on Ice, Blake Jeffrion and the Fastest Game on Earth. Sam, thanks for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
And legendary UW-Madison hockey star Blake Jeffrion is with us as well. Blake, welcome back to Wisconsin.
Yeah, thanks a lot for having me. Appreciate it.
Blake, first of all, this book covers some very painful moments in every way of the word in your story. A guy comes up to you and says, I want to write a book about these moments. Did you think twice about wanting to talk about it and relive it?
Yeah, I think my first reaction was, is this guy serious? Out of all the people and all the things in the world you could write a book about, why me? Was actually my knee-jerk and first reaction. But to answer your question more directly, I think everything in this world happens for a reason, good, bad, ugly, or indifferent. And I've taken the good, learned from the bad, and kind of moved on. I think that's how I've always been. That's how I was as a player. And, so when Sam approached me, once I got past it, he was actually real and it wasn't a college buddy messing with me. I was kind of thumbs up and let's do this.
Sam, Blake set up my first question for you. Why Blake? What led you to want to tell his story?
I had gone to Madison and Blake and I overlapped and followed his incredible career, but then followed his pro career after as well, and saw that rise and then the tragedy that ended his playing time. And the more I looked into it, the more I realized that there was so much additional that I could share and tell, and that he really was the Forrest Gump of hockey, that he had been right place, right time for so many moments in the sport for decades. And so I don't think it was that hard of a sell to convince him that there was even more to his story than maybe he realized.
Now, Blake, your earliest memories of hockey, I mentioned Hockey Dynasty, Boom Boom Jeffrion, the inventor of the slap shot. There are stories in the book about you riding your tricycle around in circles, pretending it's a Zamboni. What is your first memory of saying, this is what I want to do? I want to play hockey.
Yeah, I mean, I think there's 3 defining moments that stick out, big time for me. Number one would be, just getting on the ice and understanding that feeling and pushing around a chair and learning how to skate. Two was, the first time that I actually scored a goal, and the sensation and feeling that ran through my body. And that's when I knew I was a true competitor since a very young age. And then I think 3 was when I was a fairly young kid, and I think this story's in the book, I was shooting pucks in the backyard, and my grandfather came out, Boom Boom Jeffrion, and he goes, that's not how you shoot the puck. You shoot the puck like this, Dare. And he took my little stick, flipped it over because I was lefty, he was a righty, missed the net and put a hole through my fence. And I remember watching this puck saucer perfectly and the whole thing. And then my dad instantly came out Dad, what are you doing? I just built that fence. And, after I saw my pappy shoot the puck, I was like, oh man, I want to be that guy. I think those are the 3 defining moments of my early childhood days of wanting to be a hockey player.
And Sam, we just heard that French Canadian accent of Blake's pappy there. But Blake's growing up in the Nashville, Tennessee area. You talk about this in the book. If at that time I was looking, I was a scout, I was going to find my next hockey star, Tennessee, I wasn't going to start there, right?
Probably not. Although hockey had been creeping to Tennessee for a while, and a cool Madison connection, Bob Suter, who was on the Miracle on Ice team and as a Wisconsin native, ended up playing for a minor league team in Nashville back after the Miracle on Ice and before his pro career really took off. So that creep had been going on for a while, but Blake's dad, Danny, and then the entire Jeffreon family drove so much of that, and it really was an incredible thing for him to get drafted by his hometown team and be able to return to Nashville, you know, 10-plus years removed from his peewee days and wear the colors of the hometown NHL team.
Talking to Sam Jeffries, author of the new book Legacy on Ice, Blake Jeffreon and the Fastest Game on Earth, and UW hockey star Blake Jeffreon himself. You can join in at 800-642-1234. If you have questions for our guests, hockey memories of your own, join in at 800-642-1234. Blake, you have a great teen career going. Some people around the country very curious about where you are going to go to college. What took you to Madison?
Yeah, great question. Growing up as a kid, Michigan was always kind of my number one choice, you know, in the South. You know, the only college hockey games we got to see were the Michigan-Michigan State rival games or the national championship game or the Frozen Four. And usually Michigan was always in those games with those cool blue, you know, those blue helmets with the yellow stripes. Always wanted that helmet. And, Red Berenson, who was the coach for a long time there, was a good family friend of ours as well. So I think kind of those two were kind of the number one reasons why I wanted to go there. And really the punchline is, I'd lived in Ann Arbor for 2 years playing for Team USA and Ann Arbor's great, but I wanted something a little bit more and something, a little bit different. And when I went to Madison and just saw the football game, the small city, although very similar to Ann Arbor around, size, but a little bit bigger, a little bit more of a personality to the town, a little bit more swagger to the town, a great team. And then the ultimate, the Kohl Center. And then Mike Eaves, the head coach there at the time, his assistant, former assistant John Hines, was my head coach at USA. And they had very similar styles of play and the way they looked at the game and whatnot. And I think when you combine all of that, when I went to Madison, it was just like, oh, and don't forget the infamous college club owned by the Meyer family, because that was a selling point for me. And I think when you combine all of those, I mean, there was nothing that you wrap in the great education of Wisconsin. Truthfully, I really don't think there's a better, setup or college hockey program in the country. And I mean that, wholeheartedly, not just because I went there. It's pretty hard to beat Madison.
Sam, UW-Madison had at various points been one of the biggest teams in the country, always at or near the top. What were things like by the time that Blake ends up going to UW-Madison for the hockey program in the late 2000s?
Yeah, so Blake comes in on the heels of the 2006 national championship, and both men's and women's team won that year, so it was really a crowning achievement for the program in so many ways. And has to inherit a team with high expectations and then have to deal with his own, no offense, Blake, but big-headedness that doesn't matter what color the helmet was, probably couldn't fit it on. And it ended up being a struggle for the next couple of years and really the pathway that I think he found himself and then the team under Mike Eaves found its way back to the national championship in 2010 and really put together an incredible run that culminated in so many ways in those Mike Eaves years.
Blake, actually, let's talk about that. Sam writes about this in the book. There were a couple points in your career and a couple big ones in college where you switched your approach to the game and became more of a student of the game, more team focused. Can you talk about what changed your attitude and led to a lot of your success?
Yeah, I mean, look, I think as an 18-year-old kid being drafted as a first round, a first pick, second round of your hometown team, coming off a world championship, entering college where the team that you're going to just won, coming off the national championship and hanging out with those guys and seeing what they're like and whatnot, and then going into freshman year, being like, oh, this is going to be a cakewalk. Like, as Sam alluded to, I was big-headed, arrogant, and the whole thing, as I think any 18-year-old kid would be. and look, I had to learn and grow up and mature, and that while I was a talented guy, I wasn't the most, it didn't come naturally to me. And the core competency of why I was a good player was my work ethic, first and foremost. And if I wasn't working hard, a lot of other things weren't working, if at all. And, you know, I think it, just like anything in life, you go through, you know, iterations as a player and as a person that you need to kind of, once the season ended, I always would reflect on what I do well, what I do bad, what I need to improve on, what I need to get back to, what I need to learn from, and whatnot. And I think, you know, freshman year was a very humbling experience for me. And, you know, I got back to my core of, you know, not worrying about the extracurricular activities and, you know, focusing on the game and hockey and just working hard and then evolving from there and just keep getting better and better every year. You know, I think is the core of it.
We're talking to former pro hockey player and Badger star Blake Jeffrion, also with us Sam Jeffries, author of the new book Legacy on Ice, Blake Jeffrion and the Fastest Game on Earth. Coming up, we'll talk about the injury that ended Blake's career just a few years into his pro stint, and you can join in at 800-642-1234. Have you been a fan recently or for a long time of the UW hockey program? Did you yourself pour a lot of time and energy into playing a certain sport when those days ended? What did it mean to you? Join at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. Central Time, I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our talk with Blake Jeffrion, former Wisconsin Badger hockey star, professional hockey player, and Sam Jeffries, author of the new book, Legacy on Ice, Blake Jeffrion and the Fastest Game on Earth. You can join in at 800-642-1234. If you have questions for our guests, Blake, I want to take you now a couple years into your pro career. You've played with that hometown team in Nashville, traded to the Montreal Canadiens. It's the strike season. You're playing with the minor league team. What might look like a routine moment in hockey changed your life. If you're willing to, can you share your experience of that moment and what you remember of it and what came after?
Yeah, totally. Yeah, I mean, I remember it was we were playing a game in the Bell Center. It was during the lockout, so we wanted to give something to the fans. I was playing for the Montreal Canadiens minor league team. My mom and dad flew up. They were actually in Boston watching my brothers play and then drove up to Montreal to watch me. It was a couple shifts into the first period, and, you know, puck turned over inside the blue line of our own end. I turned it up and, you know, was going on the boards, tried to jump out of the way of a hip check. And long and short is, you know, his skate went one way, my shoulder went the other, or head went the other, kind of skate came up and hit me right in the side of the head. You know, I had suffered a lot of concussions in my career, both, you know, very, very minor to all of being knocked out and unconscious. So, I had known what a concussion felt like, and I'd known if I'd had one. And after that collision happened, which was a hard collision, I definitely thought I did. But when I, you know, when that happens to me, usually my peripheral vision goes. So it looks like you're, you know, it seems as if you're looking down, like, look, you have two straws you're looking down. It's kind of the best way to describe it. And I didn't have that. So I was sitting on my knees and, you know, kind of waiting for a second. And then, you know, of course, a fight breaks out, or, you know, a scrum breaks out. And then, you know, I kind of stood up, I sat back, put my head up, and I just felt like a warm sensation go down my back, which was a bunch of blood. And then I was like, oh man, I gotta get off the ice. So I skated off the ice with my head kind of over, you know, and I get to the trainer's room, or I'm sorry, get to the bench, but my trainer's met with a towel. You know, he puts it up. I go into the trainer's room. They don't know where I'm kind of bleeding from. And long story short is I had a pretty severe cut in the side of my head, and they, looked at it and kind of disappeared very quickly. Mind you, these guys all are speaking in French, so I don't know what they're saying whatsoever. And, they come flying back 100 miles an hour with the doctor. A doctor says, you know, something very quickly in French, and everything started moving very quickly from there on out. You know, next thing I know, my mom and dad are down there. I'm in a stretcher and I'm off to the hospital. The last memory I had before I went unconscious was, you know, I went into the hospital in a stretcher, looking up into those, you know, one of those rooms that's really cold. And, I passed out. And the punchline there is I had a depressed cold fracture and internal bleeding on my brain, which caused me to kind of, you know, go unconscious. Mm-hmm. So that was the last thing I remember until I woke up, I don't remember how many hours, but a lot of hours later. So,
and Sam, I'm not an athlete. I'm a parent of athletes, not at Blake's level. My first thought was his parents are there, right? And when you see your kid down, you don't know what's happened. You talk to Blake's family members about their experience. Could you talk about how they talked about that moment?
Yeah, and it was really one of the amazing things for the Jeffreyon family to be so open with me. His mom, Kelly, who's a tremendous storyteller, walked me through being in the stands and I think being a little casual when it first happened, because they have Blake is not their only son. They all play hockey. They've seen
injuries before.
Injuries. Yeah. That's right. They've seen injuries. They've seen concussions. And I remember her telling me, first thought was, another concussion. And kind of, you know, girding themselves for that recovery. And it wasn't until being in the hospital and having to rush Blake to surgery that they really understood that this time was different and the seriousness of it. Speaking French or not, that really came through very quickly. And so she was open and transparent, and then had to, unfortunately, be the one to make the call to Blake's fiance at the time, and his now wife, Kaylin. And Kaylin was taking a night off from law school, having a well-deserved break with friends, and gets the call, not having in her mind Blake's playing schedule, not knowing where and when the game was that night. And, you know, immediately fell to her knees and broke down and really described being near catatonic, traveling from Chicago to Montreal to be with him bedside. So it was, and everyone I talked to, there was a real delayed reaction. I think nobody understood the danger or the risks. And then I spoke to the surgeon and the trainer, and I think for the medical side, they all understood very quickly how bad this was, how close he was to do something far more severe than what happened, and how lucky it was that there was no NHL that night, because they actually had the best in the business sitting there ringside ready to help.
Talking to Sam Jeffries, author of the new book, Legacy on Ice, Blake Jeffreyon and the Fastest Game on Earth, and Blake Jeffreyon himself, former pro and UW-Madison hockey player. Blake, there's a moment in the book after this injury, the recovery, it takes time, it's difficult, and you're evaluating hockey, and the thought might be, do you make a comeback, do you not? And it seems like you're asking yourself, even before the injury, was it worth it? Is this where I want to be? Can you talk about that a little?
Yeah, no, totally. I mean, look, I think, I had suffered 13 documented concussions in my career. We all know the short-term and long-term effects of concussions, or what's out there. And, I had spoken to a lot of people, both former players, current players, neurologists. I mean, anyone and everyone, you pretty much name it, I had spoken to. And what the common theme that kept coming back was, Blake, it's actually, it's scientifically proven that it's not actually as a big of a deal if you suffer a lot of concussions. It's around two core competencies, and that is, number one, does the time period that you're out continue to get longer and longer? Is the first and foremost question you have to ask yourself. And then secondly, how often are they occurring, inside that? And I would say, historically, when I had suffered a concussion, I was usually back within, a couple of days to a week, feeling pretty much ready to go. And I would say my last two concussions that I had suffered previously were fairly within reach of each other. And both of those were, I was out longer term, and they were, each of those consecutively were longer durations of being out. And then when you suffer something like this, it's actually substantially worse than a concussion, obviously. And, you know, it's actually, you know, a bruise to your brain. And you know, everyone was just like, look, dude, you can go, like, if, first of all, if you can find a doctor to let you play and is willing to assume liability, you know, by all means, best of luck to you on that one. But secondly, like, there's no way that you can, that you should come back and play. You should move on, live a long and happy life, and not have, you know, long-term effects associated with this, and go do something else. And, you know, so it was kind of writing on the wall, and that's how I'd always kind of made every decision, was kind of, you know, if you talk to enough people, usually you get a gut feeling around it, the right decision to make, and, or, it kind of slaps you in the face on what you should do in life. You know, turn to the ones you're closest with and people that know the most about that industry. And I think after I did that, it was kind of, you know, the writing was on the wall. It was time for me to step away and go do something else.
You did continue to work in hockey. You did some time as a scout and into management. You still love the game?
I still do love the game. You know, as you said, you know, I went on to be a scout, and as I like to call it, a road warrior, and then into management. But, you know, ultimately, you know, still love the game, still watch it. I just made a bet with my dad over the weekend that I still think Connor McDavid will lead the NHL in scoring this year. It's nice that he's got 11 points in his last three games. No, I still love the game, still follow pretty closely. I have a lot of friends that still play. But, you know, going through all this, I think the one thing that I've found is that family and friends are most important to me. And I was no longer willing to sacrifice those relationships in exchange for the game of hockey. So moved on to do something else.
And we'll leave it there. Blake, thanks for joining us today.
Anytime, guys. Thanks for having me. And Sam, as always, pal, good to see you. And thanks for writing the book, pal.
Yeah. And Sam, thanks for being with us.
Yeah. I'm grateful for the time and, excited to hear what people think. It was a special journey to be able to write it and something else to have it out in the world and for Blake's kids and my own to be able to read it one day.
We've been talking to former pro hockey player and UW-Madison star Blake Jeffrion and author Sam Jeffries. Sam's new book is called Legacy on Ice, Blake Jeffrion and the Fastest Game on Earth. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Parrott. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Social media use was on the rise for years and years, but there are some signs that those trends are tapering off. And a lot of people are turning instead to a different way of connecting online with friends and family, group chats and texts. Whether it's WhatsApp, Messenger, Discord, or just regular old cell phone text messages, people are turning toward this more direct form of group communication instead of relying on social media algorithms to mediate their interactions. Like any platform, group chats have their own set of social dynamics and etiquette that come with up and downsides. We're exploring the rise of group messaging, how we communicate over text with different social groups. You could join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have some kind of group chat, maybe with family members, a particular group of friends? How do they work for you? Do you like them as a way to keep up with people? Or do all the messages start to become too much? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Catalina Toma is an associate professor of communication science at UW-Madison. She researches how people interact over communication technologies. Catalina, welcome back to Central Time.
Thanks for having me. Always a pleasure.
I've been seeing articles about the rise of group chat and thought, well, I don't really do that. And then I thought, well, wait, I've got one with my, you know, immediate family and one with my parents, one with my band and one with my football buddies and things like that. It kind of snuck up on me. Is this a big trend that we're seeing out there, people turning toward group text as a mode of communication?
I think it is. I think we're seeing definitely an increase in this new form of communication. And it's really interesting to think about why we're seeing this migration, as you said, from social media platforms, social networking sites, to these more personalized, private forms of communication. And I have some theories about that. I'm happy to share. One, I think COVID played a big part in this, where opportunities for face-to-face contact were severely limited, and there was a need to talk to the people nearest and dearest to us, and these platforms provided that opportunity. But second, and I think a little bit more interestingly, is that people have kind of matured in their use of social networking sites, and they've realized that maybe not everybody is interested in seeing what they converse about in a mundane way with friends and family, right? Because that's what would happen when we would, you know, tag each other and post on each other's walls and comment and talk to each other in a public forum. You know, social networking sites are an interesting environment because they connect us with really large and diverse audiences. We call this context collapse, right? When we talk to people publicly on social media, we talk to groups of people who we would never talk to simultaneously. It could be your friends and your family and your romantic partner and your boss and your coworkers and a bunch of strangers and some people you met at a party. You would never talk to these people together simultaneously, but on social media you can. And that definitely has some cons. So it makes sense for people to move away from those more indiscriminate broadcasting types of communication to more personalized and private and targeted communications through group chat.
Yeah, it seems like so much of social media incentivizes you to go big, to have a wider reach, to expand your group of friends or followers or whatever the particular platform has, and get messages that lots of people see. That group chat, you know exactly how many people you're reaching, and you have no incentive to try to go beyond that.
Exactly. Social networking site companies, you know, Facebook, Twitter, X, Snapchat, so on and so forth, are trying to get people to publicize as much as possible, to engage, to share, to overshare, because that's what attracts attention. But from the user perspective, that's not always wise or beneficial. So users are opting increasingly for more privacy, and that's what we're seeing with group chats.
Is there something about the technology that's making group chat easier? I mean, there are different apps that are better at it, but I've also noticed there used to be Apple Android divides where things functioned differently. Is it just a smoother, less friction-y technology now?
It is smoother. And I think, looking back, I think that was one of the big appeals of WhatsApp when it first started to get traction. It really facilitated group chats, and, you know, it enabled you to give these groups names and use emojis to cutify the name and invite people and so on and so forth. And that was a real draw of the platform at the time that users enjoyed.
Can you talk about how we define social groups within these group chats? Again, on Facebook, say our social group is everybody who has friended us and whoever they share it with. Now it seems like we're defining things in a different way when we're selectively saying this goes to group A, this goes to group B.
Right. And I would say, very broadly speaking, there could be two types of groups. You know, the more permanent groups that you constantly talk to, and very typically people have a group for family members, people have a group for close friends or different groups of friends that they talk to on the regular. But there's also more temporary groups, like event-based groups. We're organizing this dinner with so-and-so, and we want to talk about the logistics, and we create a very temporary group for that, and that goes away. But what's really interesting to me is the more permanent groups that allow for the sense of connection and sharing in a really non-frictiony way, right? Like, because there's many members of the group, everybody can contribute a little bit. You can feel connected to the group without a deep expense of energy on anybody's side.
Talking to Catalina Toma with the UW-Madison Communication Science Department, looking at the rise of group texting, group chats as a way for people to communicate online instead of, in many cases, social media platforms. Is this you? Are you doing this? Join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have that chat going, maybe with family members, a group of friends or coworkers, or fill in the blank? What do you use it for? Is it ever too much? Do you ever look at your phone and say, what the heck's going on? Why do I have all these messages? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. I'm seeing a lot of articles and comments out there, Catalina, about, yeah, it's getting overwhelming. People use these things in a different way. I'll give one example. In my band, we have a group. It's usually very practical. Is there practice tonight? Here's our latest band files, whatever. And then sometimes three of us get going chatting about something, and the fourth one hates that and doesn't want to see all those messages pop up. How do we negotiate that kind of etiquette, not just in my band, but in whatever group we happen to be in?
Yeah, that's really interesting conversations to be had. And I think people are aware of what's interesting to whom, but also the technology allows you to ignore messages pretty easily and without a lot of cost, right? So I don't know about your group member who's annoyed. It's probably me. I would probably just not read those messages. But if the annoyance is expressed, then you can, of course, take the conversation elsewhere. You can create a different group where everybody's interested. In my experience, and from what I know of research in the psychology of these technologies, people enjoy this sense of connection that doesn't require a lot of effort. Mm-hmm. Even if you might not read everything, getting those notifications feels good because you're part of a conversation. People think about you. You're included. And all of those are really important psychological signifiers for people that feel really great.
There is now a separate group for everyone but the guitarist. So it worked itself out. Let's bring on a caller at 800-642-1234. Rachel is with us in Eau Claire. Rachel, hi.
Hi. Thanks for having me. I wanted to comment about the differing media literacy that we have in the world and how many people fake identities and how there's often gatekeeping and less social interaction based on gatekeeping. Tries to educate based on tics, Tourette's diagnosis, Tourette syndrome, about what different aspects of it mean. People on TikTok came at me, attacked me. They found out where I went to university and they reported me to the university. And I'm like, I try to educate people, but you're going to be mean. Let's go group chat.
Rachel, I gotcha. Thanks a lot for the call. Not a great signal there, but Rachel, talk about some of the risks of those much more public-facing sites, in this case, TikTok, versus having that group chat with people you're not as likely to be attacked by, say, total strangers on that personal group chat.
Absolutely. I really enjoyed Rachel's point and her emphasis on some of the more serious risks of posting on social media, right? It's not just oversharing and giving too much information to friends and family in a way that it could make they could be annoyed with you, but very serious risks like identity theft and so on and so forth. So to mitigate those risks of social media, moving to more private channels of communication makes a lot of sense. And I really love that Rachel brought on the concept of social media literacy, which is something we're all working on, right? And it's not always super obvious on how to navigate these complicated spaces, which is why we have programs like this one.
Mm-hmm. Thanks a lot for the call, Rachel. We are talking to UW-Madison Communication Science Professor Catalina Toma about group chats, group texts, how we communicate to our friends and family at the same time over text, maybe instead of social media, maybe replacing some of the ways we've used social media. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have a group chat? Do you have lots and lots of group chats? Do you like them? What do you use them for? Practical stuff, fun stuff, a little bit of both? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll continue the conversation, maybe hear from you, coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our conversation with Catalina Toma, Associate Professor of Communication Science at UW-Madison, who researches social interaction over digital platforms. We're talking about one of those platforms now, the rise in popularity of group chats and text groups as a form of communication among family, friends, coworkers, you name it. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have group texts or group chats in your social group, your friends, your family? Do you like it? Does it get a little much? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Let's go back to your calls now. Libby is with us in Mosinee. Libby, hello.
Hello.
What did you want to tell us about?
Well, you know, I have several groups in WhatsApp, and we actually also connect on Facebook. And I've been living here in the U.S. since I was 18, and I'm 55 now. And I reconnected with my friends from elementary school. We have not seen each other for 45 years.
Wow.
And it started with my best friends, a group of three, and then we ended up adding 25 out of the 32. And I also have my group from middle school and my group from high school down in Panama while I'm here. And we communicate constantly, and there's like a zillion notifications, but whoever doesn't want it, they can turn it off. It's energizing. I really love it. My day's busy because I teach, I just ignore it. And then I go to it during the weekend when I have time. So it's very convenient.
Thank you so much for sharing that. I'm glad you're able to reconnect with old friends back in, I think you said, Panama. And Catalina, international communication has been difficult and expensive for many years, and now it's almost free for people in Libby's situation. Could you talk about how this has changed how we communicate across not just state lines, but across international lines?
No, absolutely. This is a great point. And I think this is where WhatsApp really shone in the beginning, because it was a web-based application that anybody with an internet connection could use, as opposed to regular text messages that you'd have to be a subscriber for and pay for. So it allowed people across the world to communicate with one another and connect across geographical boundaries. And that's such a gift and contributes so much to people's well-being and ability to stay in touch. So I really appreciate that point. And Libby also talked about some features of online communication of these group texts that are really beneficial, such as they're kind of asynchronous in the sense that you don't have to respond right away. You don't have to engage right away in the same way that you would with a telephone call, right? You can take your time, you can engage at your convenience on the weekend or whatever works for you. And that could be really, really beneficial. In fact, this is why people prefer texting over, say, the telephone, kind of in a more general sense. And they've developed research identifies this interesting phenomenon of phone fears, right? When the phone rings, you're almost worried because it's probably something bad and it's probably something serious. That's when people feel like it's okay to intrude, to stop whatever you're doing so you can take the phone call. Whereas a group chat or any text for that matter, you can engage with at your convenience. And that's really great.
Thanks a lot for that call at 800-642-1234. Al joins us next in Green Bay. Al, hi.
Hey, thanks for putting me on. So the setup for this is I'm a professional driver. Every time the Tampa Bay Buccaneers come to Green Bay, they hire our firm to move their owners around. There's five owners, their brothers and sisters, come from different locations. So we have one driver assigned to each one of these owners. On the Sunday morning of the game, the security guy sits down with us and he takes every one group text.
We're losing.
It doesn't matter what color your phone. It doesn't matter what color your phone is. Doesn't matter. You don't need an app. You just need the ability to text, right? So then, I text when I depart for the airport. I text when I've got my passenger on. I text when I got my passenger off. The security guy stays in one place. And he immediately knows at any given time where any of the five people are that he's worried about.
Interesting. Al, thanks a lot for sharing that with us. You're cutting in and out there a little bit. Next time you see him, say maybe they should sell Manchester United, by the way. But this is a very practical use, a one-off use. We've got this logistical situation, and we're using this group chat to manage it, Catalina.
Absolutely. We call these acts micro-coordination, right? Texting really allows you to coordinate with multiple people almost in real time if everybody's connected simultaneously and knows that they're important. It's important to converse in real time. And you can do those with many people and with much less effort than on a phone call. And that's a really valuable aspect of texting.
Al, thanks a lot for that call. We are talking about the rise of group texts, group chats as a way to communicate with friends, family, fellow drivers, as it turns out in this case. Still time for you to join in with your experience, for good or ill, with group texting, group chats at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can email ideas at WPR.org or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Now, texting has been around for a long time. Usually it was a two-way. It could be I text you, you text me back, that sort of thing. What are you watching for as our use of group chats evolves and group texting evolves?
Well, it's interesting to think about group size. You know, what is a good group size for having those conversations and how group size and composition will affect what it is that people talk about. And it's interesting to look at psychological effects. I mean, we predict that people enjoy these group communication because more people are using them. But it's important to study why they enjoy it, you know, what psychological benefits of connection people get through it, but also the bad side, like what are some troublesome conversations that could be had What are some blind spots that people could be having and maybe oversharing depending on the composition and the size of the group?
And then the question of why am I not in this group?
Right. So a lot of technologies make exclusion a little invisible. Like if you're not part of the group, you don't know what's going on. So it doesn't hurt in the same way as seeing people in the office in that corner talking amongst themselves without you. So being excluded is a little bit less obvious. But when it does become obvious, it's as painful as any other exclusion.
And our caller earlier, Libby, mentioned, you know, some of these group chats are 20-some people. That seems like a lot to manage.
That is a lot to manage. And this is what I hear anecdotally from my students, too. When groups become too large, they become dysfunctional, as in there's not a suitable conversation for everybody. So we have to move away from those groups and maybe create new ones.
Let's bring on another caller. Chris is with us in Menominee. Chris, hi.
Hi. So as it pertains to social media and the public realm, I currently work with a company who employs another company to pre-screen all potential applicants by not just doing a background check, but they check all of their social media, anything that you would post publicly, Facebook or X or what have you, and anything that's maybe radical or extreme could certainly cost somebody the ability to gain employment. So,
interesting.
You know,
Chris, thanks a lot for the call. A lot of that out there, barring a subpoena, as some famous crypto entrepreneurs have discovered, mostly that kind of our texts or group texts aren't going to come up in that kind of screening process, I would assume. Catalina.
They are not. They are not. And that's a real advantage. I mean, we've all heard the stories of employers and significant others like scrutinizing stuff that's being posted publicly in a way that was never intended by the poster. And that could have really serious repercussions. And this, you know, privacy risk is one of the reasons people move away to more private channels of communication.
Thanks for the call, Chris. Time for another caller. Bonnie is with us in Lake Geneva. Bonnie, hi.
Hi, how are you today?
Good. What's your group text story?
Hi, how are you today?
Good. Bonnie, what did you want to tell us about?
Well, I have a lot of siblings, and we have a group chat called the Cool Cats, Cool Cats 2, and we're very busy on it, but it gets crazy during Green Bay Packers games.
Awesome, Bonnie. Thanks. I have a group of friends around the country now, and the only time pretty much we activate the group text is during a Packer game, maybe the Super Bowl. It's a nice way for occasional communication, Catalina.
Absolutely. I used to have a group chat where we would Wordle. Do you remember Wordle
when
it first came up? And we would share the Wordles every morning, and then we got tired of it after a while. But it was one of those situational group chats that gives you some enjoyment about sharing something you have in common.
Thanks a lot for that. Before we run out of time, I want to talk about this as an intergenerational thing. Because, like, okay, maybe adults do Facebook, kids do Insta or whatever they're doing now. My kids will be on the group chats. My parents will be on the group chats. It seems to be a place where people of different ages can come together.
I'm so glad that you brought that up. I think that's really interesting. And one of the sticky points that this brings forth is the issue of literacy, right? Different generations might have different comfort levels with the group chats. And that's why even though it's possible to have group chats on platforms like Facebook or Snapchat, they might not be as accessible intergenerationally as something really, really simple, like just texting or just WhatsApp. We got to keep those considerations in mind.
All right. Just a personal question. How many group chats do you reckon you have going at any given time?
I have, maybe four or five.
Okay.
I guess not a ton, but I enjoy all of them. Even if they're talking about stuff that doesn't pertain to me directly, it's really nice to be included in the conversation, be a fly on the wall. I enjoy them a lot.
Catalina, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us.
Thanks so much for having me.
Catalina Toma is an associate professor of communication science at UW-Madison. She's with us today to talk about group chats and group texting and why more and more of us are communicating with friends, family, and others over shared text messages, maybe instead of social media platforms. I'm Rob Ferret. Stick around. There's more to come on Central Time. You're listening to The Ideas Network.